Welcome to the Daily News Podcast. I'm Caitlin Kelleher, the Director of Multimedia for the Metro West Daily News and the Milford Daily News. I'm filling in for Anne Brennan, who is on vacation this week. We are going to be talking about some stories from the arrest of two suspects in a Holliston bank robbery that occurred in October of 2017, an experience with our photographer and reporter who got to go along with the Franklin Police Department on an active shooter drill, as well as some local government and politics news that includes angry hams being back in front of the Liquor Commission and Licensing Board and the future of the Hopedale Draper Revitalization Project. First with me is Norm Miller, who is our cops and crime reporter and our beer nut.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
All right. First up, the Holliston bank robbery situation. I know it occurred in October, and I know that the police and the FBI put out a reward about 8 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago at this point?
Something like that, yeah. Well, basically, the robbery occurred, like you said, occurred in October. Both suspects were wearing Halloween masks. They knew one was a male and one was a female in general build, but that's the only information they had. They had nothing. So they put out the FBI put an award out for $10,000, and, you know, you put $10,000 out there, and suddenly no information becomes lots of information. And someone who identified as a friend of Priscilla DeSena, one of the two suspects.
And she's the one who was arrested locally.
Yeah, she was arrested in Boston. She was in a treatment facility there, halfway house. She has a heroin addiction.
Okay, she's a Milford resident.
Originally from Milford. Came forward and as an anonymous source and gave the information that basically said DeSena admitted talking about it, even showed video of like the security video that all the newscasts had and was talking about it. They got away allegedly with about $4,700. So when they got this information, they actually met with DeSena about a week before they arrested her in Boston. She admitted to her role in the robbery, police said. And last week, they arrested her co-conspirator boyfriend, Oliver Walsh, originally from Hopedale. They arrested him down in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. Then they arrested her the following day. Since then, she's been held without bail. They had a dangerousness hearing to see if she was too dangerous to be released to the public, and the judge agreed, holding her without bail for 90 days. Her lawyer tried to argue that she was an abused woman who was basically forced and coerced to do this by her boyfriend, but the judge still held her. Walsh hasn't been arraigned yet. He have to go through a rendition process to come from Pennsylvania up to Massachusetts. I'm not sure where it stands. Just about 5 minutes before I'm speaking to you, I actually called Holliston Police to see if he's been picked up yet. And as far as I know, at least the person I spoke to, he has not.
Okay.
So it's just waiting now. She's held without bail. She'll be in court next month for a probable cause hearing, which will basically allow them to keep holding her without bail. He'll probably, when he comes up, he'll go through the whole same process. He'll go through the arraignment process, and then just based on the original, DeSena, they'll probably ask for him to be held as a danger as well, and they'll have to go through a whole hearing.
And I wonder if he might also be considered a flight risk because
he's already in
Pennsylvania.
Yeah. And the fact is, the gun, I don't believe it's ever been recovered.
Okay.
They know it's a real gun. DeSena, at least police said, admitted that she stole the gun from her friend with the intention of returning the gun after the robbery. And as far as from the testimony from the hearing the other day, the gun was never returned.
Okay.
So that's something else that might play into it. Interestingly, unrelated to the robbery, Oliver Walsh was actually scheduled to go to trial on Tuesday in Worcester District Court for assault and battery with a dangerous weapon for hitting DeSena in the head with a laptop computer.
Oh, geez.
About a year ago, and she suffered like a laceration to her head, and he was actually scheduled for trial on the day after the dangerousness hearing for DeSena. Obviously, he's out of state, so the trial didn't happen.
Right, and it sounds like, so that's going to be rescheduled, and there's sounds like these two might end up starting to play into each other.
Yeah.
If, with, at least with her defense attorneys.
Yeah, I mean, the defense attorney, you know, already trying to use as a, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but that she's a battered woman who was forced into this by her abusive boyfriend. And
right.
The fact that he was scheduled to go to trial the next day after the judge ruled that the girlfriend was too dangerous to release, that will probably be used as a future argument as well.
Right. That makes sense. So, you know, your other beat is our local Beer Nut column. Mm-hmm. And I know that you and Nicole always do your Beer for Everyone project.
Yes.
But other than that, what else is going on?
Well, one of Massachusetts' newer breweries is actually celebrating their first anniversary this weekend, River Styx Brewing in Worcester, in Fitchburg.
Okay.
They're doing like a big four-day celebration beginning on Thursday. So when you hear this on Friday,
yep,
they'll have a bunch of special beers on tap. They have a special anniversary beer, which is really cool process to do. It's a $40 bottle, which seems over the top price-wise. But
that better be a very nice bottle.
But it's the process. It's kind of a unique process. They basically bought French oak barrels, filled it up with unaged whiskey to make it into bourbon, take the bourbon out, fill it with maple syrup. So they bourbon barrel age this maple syrup, which they also sell in the tap room. Then they have this bourbon and maple syrup line barrel. They put this imperial stout in, age it for about a year. And then they bottle that. So it's been like a year-long process.
I was going to say, so it sounds like they really planned this from the very beginning then.
From what I understand, this is something they did on a smaller scale as home brewers.
Okay.
So they did this for a larger scale. So they it's $40 a bottle. It's going to be released one time this weekend. Once it's gone, it's gone.
Wow.
And from what I understand, I don't buy maple syrup because I can't make pancakes and waffles at home because I'm terrible, terrible, terrible cook.
Yeah.
But from what I understand, the maple syrup they actually sell is supposedly amazing because you get like the little bourbon flavors mixed in with the maple syrup that they age themselves.
Right, which just must give it a deep, rich flavor.
Yeah, so you can always just get that in tap room. But yeah, it's in Fitchburg, River Styx Brewing, and yeah, there's always a bunch of things going on. Springdale Barrel Room / Jack's Abbey is co-sponsoring what's called We're Funked Beer Festival. It started last year when a very popular brewery got bought out by Anheuser-Busch. They used to put on this very large sour beer festival, and it was all for charity. But when Anheuser-Busch bought them, a lot of the breweries that typically go backed out because they're mm-hmm. against. So Jack's Abbey / Springdale and Night Shift Brewing from Everett moved in to fill the void. They have this big beer festival that's going to be happening next month. All these sour beers and a lot of the proceeds go to charity. They attract breweries from around the country. So you're getting like a lot of sour beers that you normally can't get. For those who don't know, a lot of sour beers go for $30, $40 a bottle because it takes so long because you can truly, like a lambic, for example, could be in an oak barrel for a year or two before it's ready to be drank.
Oh, wow.
So it's a long, exhaustive process. So they're getting a lot of these beers that you probably wouldn't be able to afford that you can try all in one place.
That sounds fascinating because sour beers are not one. I think they seem to be growing in popularity as opposed to being something that everybody already knows about.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I know this is not a beer podcast, but sour beer is really just a catch-all term. There's like tart, there's different types of wild yeast or even bacteria you use to get these different sour beers. So even within the sour beer category, there's totally different flavors. So a Berliner Weiss will taste nothing like a Goose, or a Gozer will not taste like a lambic, or an American wild ale won't, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And these are, you know, it's really...
I say right like I know what I'm talking, like I know what you're talking about.
But it's funny though, like a lot of the stuff in these beers are stuff that winemakers go out of the way to make sure don't infect their wines. But sour beers seem to be the big beer that attracts wine drinkers. Like a lot of the wine drinkers love the different types of sour beers.
Oh, like, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I know. I've always found that interesting because they do have some of them do have like a wine-like quality. But it's funny, if you have a friend who's like, I'm not a big fan of beer, but I love wine, get a lambic. And there's more likely than not, if they're going to like a beer, it'll probably be a lambic or a goose or something
I'll
like that.
I'll have to try that next time I'm out.
Yeah. So that's just a little interesting thing. But that'll be coming up next month. And just make sure tune in every Friday for the Beer for Everyone project with myself and Nicole Simmons.
Yep, and it's available through iTunes and Google Play and everything like that.
Yep,
too,
and it'll be on MetroWestDailyNews.com and WickedLocal.com.
It is. All right, thanks for joining us, Norm. Now we are going to talk to Jim Hadidin, who is our Framingham reporter, and one of the stories that you've covered and is back in the news this week is the issues at Ingraham's. What's going on now?
So this latest issue dates back to May, around the last time this bar/restaurant was in the news for suspension hearing before the city's Board of License Commissioners. So some of our readers may recall Ingraham's received a 5-day liquor license suspension for failing to properly notify the police department about a fight that had occurred in its parking lot. So around the same time they were before the Board of License Commissioners, the Alcoholic Beverages Control Commission, which is the state board that acts underneath the treasurer's office, had an investigator stop by the business, and they do these kind of periodic checks at different businesses just to see that things are running the way they're supposed to. So there was a group of investigators who went on one evening around 11 o'clock and saw some youthful patrons inside, asked them for identification, and determined that two of the people there were underage. They had both presented ID cards to the bouncer when they came in. One of them was a fraudulent New Hampshire license for a guy who was 20 years old, and his license claimed that he was 24 years old, something along those lines. And the other one was a woman who was 20 years old, had given the security folks her sister's ID, which indicated that she was older than she was, in fact. So they were before the ABCC again on Tuesday this week to kind of deal with the fallout from that incident. And they are facing one potential violation of the liquor license for allowing an illegality to take place on their premises.
Okay. Have they already served out their 5-day suspension at this point? You know?
I don't actually know the answer to that.
Okay.
I would assume it has been a little while. I think they've probably done it by now, but in terms of the city suspension, I'm not sure when they chose to serve that.
At the last commission meetings, has there been any discussion about how many more strikes or how many more problems this bar and this ownership are going to be able to have before there's discussion about removing a license? Because I feel like that's a lot of what the questions that have been on our Facebook page about this have been.
Well, there was definitely, the Board of License Commissioners made it very clear that they were not pleased with the business and wanted to see some progress toward, making sure all the protocols there fall in line with what the city needs for a liquor license holder. We've seen some comments from people on our Facebook page and elsewhere that feel like Ingraham's is not a positive presence in the city. Others, I think, enjoy going there, and it should be noted, they did host some community events in the recent past.
Right.
The people who have been active in politics have been scheduling some of their functions there. So, there are different ways to view that business, but I think there was definitely some displeasure with what has occurred in the recent past and kind of, maybe the just general rowdiness that surrounds that business at certain times.
Right, and it sounds like this will be an interesting to watch as different pieces of this develop over the next few months and to see whether or not they can stay out of trouble with both the state and the local licensing authority.
Get some kind of decision from the ABCC in the next couple of weeks, I think.
One of the other stories you had was, again, a licensing story, but this one is for the scrap business. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that story?
Yeah, so another business that has taken some heat from residents in years past is Conigliaro Industries, which is a recycling yard that has got a sizable property off of Waverly Street and Fountain Street. So they've been there since at least 1990, taking in various kind of used goods, scrap metal, you know, they've had mattresses and things like that. So just a variety of stuff, and then they can recycle it or sell it secondhand. And they've done that for a number of years. But one interesting aspect of this business is it is owned by Greg Conigliaro, who is one of the co-founders of the New England Compounding Center, the compounding pharmacy that was shut down amid this, just terrible incident that occurred with tainted drugs being sent out to people around the country, leading to a number of deaths, a number of illnesses. So that obviously led to criminal charges against a variety of people. Greg Conigliaro himself was indicted on one charge that had to do with being part of this alleged conspiracy to defraud the government around what had gone on at the compounding center. So, you know, when all this unfolded, Conigliaro Industries, which is not part of the New England Compounding Center, was before the Board of Selectmen about 3 years ago to ask for a license to resell secondhand goods, which is something it had been doing for a number of years, but because of various changes was required to ask for this permission from the town at the time. And Selectmen at the time said that they weren't comfortable granting that. They looked at the connection between Greg Conigliaro and the Compounding Center and just said, you know, we don't think this is someone who has shown fitness to operate, to expand his commercial activity in the community. So fast forward 3 years, the city council took up this issue and took very much the same position, said that they were still troubled by what had happened at the New England Compounding Center. They voted last week to deny that scrap license for the business. And the other, you know, there were also some concerns about just generally the condition of the property. It can look shabby at times. They take in a lot of stuff, and I guess there's been some issue getting some of the material that they hold off of the property, especially with what's going on with recycling globally right now. It's become more difficult for places to recycle a lot of stuff that they used to have an easier time with because of global trade in various ways. So there was also comments from at least one city councilor that he just generally didn't kind of like the way that the property had been kept up, or kind of how responsive Conigliaro Industries has been in the past to concerns from neighbors about the condition of the property.
So what is going to be the next step in this process for either the city council or for Conigliaris? Do they have a chance to go back and say, we've done stuff to fix this up?
I don't think there's any prescribed process for them to wait a certain amount of time and reapply. I guess they could reapply in the near future if they wanted to. But they didn't have anyone at the city council meeting to speak in their favor. Perhaps that means they got wind that this was not going to go in their favor. What's interesting about this is Conigliaro did have permission from the state, I think the state DEP or some entity, to do the secondhand reselling that they were doing in the past. So perhaps that would give them some means to go to a state court or something like that and say, we were improperly denied this permission by the city of Framingham, and we've been doing it for years and are grandfathered in, or something like that. But that's just speculation on my part.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and thanks for sharing the details of this story. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Caitlin.
Thanks. Hi, this is Caitlin Kelleher, the Director of Multimedia for the Metro West and Milford Daily News. I'm now joined by Scott Casaleo out of our Milford office, who spent yesterday with the Franklin Police Department doing an active shooter drill. Welcome, Scott.
Hello.
So this is, I assume, your first time going in a simulation with one of our local police departments. How did it come about?
Yeah, so Sergeant Brian Johnson with the Franklin Police reached out to me asking if I'd like to take part in this active shooter training, not only cover it, but actually wear the gear, take a gun with me, and take part in the actual training.
Okay. What was it like going out there? I mean, yesterday, a lot of the article you wrote was in the first person because you got to be able to describe it. But as you arrived at the high school, what was your experience like?
So the officers had told me that we would be using paintballs in order to simulate. And in my mind, before I got there, I was thinking traditional paintball guns. And I said, okay, maybe a little messy and not as realistic, but it will do the job. And when I got there, I just heard these actual gunshots echoing through the hallway. And I thought to myself, these are not paintball guns. What they are real guns with modified slides and modified ammunition called simmunition that have little tiny paintball tips, but they weigh the same as normal bullets and they look the same. And I'm not going to say they don't hurt. They definitely hurt. They just do not pierce your skin.
Okay. So was there anything that surprised you about the way this simulation worked and your experiences?
I want to say that everything surprised me. So it started off, we started off in the cruisers. We got the call over the radio telling us there was an active shooter in the building. Obviously, we were told it was a drill first.
Right.
And so Officer Jack Flynn, who I was sitting in the cruiser with, grabbed his rifle out of the middle of the seat while I ran to the back and put on some body armor. We took some cover as we were running toward the entrance to the building. And as we got to the entrance, the officer playing the shooter started shooting outside the door. And, you know, adrenaline was just surging as we were shooting back. But it was very coordinated. There was no, you know, we weren't free for all. Everyone was communicating, telling each other where to go. I myself didn't even feel in disarray because everyone, I just followed the lead of everyone else and everything worked out well. We cornered him and took him down within 5 minutes, both drills that I did.
That's really great. One of the things that in your story you said, you reported that one of the Franklin, I think it was the Franklin chief, who had said 20 years ago before Columbine happened, they would have, the tradition was to, if with an active shooter, was to call in the SWAT team, which I assume was a regional group. And now it's local officers really being trained to respond to this. Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So Police Chief Thomas Lynch, he went through, he was on the police force when Columbine happened. He was relatively new to the force. And before 1999, they would send in the SWAT, as you said, and it took longer for the SWAT to get there, get coordinated. That's why the Columbine High School shooting was, it went on for so long, is because police officers couldn't get inside the building. So they had to wait for SWAT. After that shooting, they started training police officers with a lot of the SWAT methods and equipping cruisers with more of that SWAT equipment, including the body armor, including the long guns, which officers didn't previously carry. And this training is, in all intents and purposes, a sort of SWAT training, except for now it's accessible for local police departments.
We've had a number of school shootings this year. A lot of, we've had students come in, talk to us about those experiences and what the national stories are doing to their local psyche. I assume the police officers take these drills very seriously because of the national climate. Could you feel that in the air yesterday?
Oh yes. They, you know, the mood was light because we all knew it was a simulation, but the connotations behind it and the seriousness of it was all there as well. Everyone I spoke with said, you know, it's incredible to be able to have this kind of training under their belts, but they hope to God they'll never, ever have to use it.
Right. And they do it after the school year ends at this point without the students in the building.
Correct.
Which is different, but they also participate, I assume, in trainings when kids are there, but it's more the lockdown style as opposed to actually going through the school. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Is there anything else that, from your experience, that you think the listeners really should be able to get out of it? Because there are photos in your full stories on our website.
Yeah, I mean, being someone who did it myself, I got to give a lot of credit to the guys that can run around with that body armor and that mask on and still get to their target. Because let me tell you, I was winded and my mask was fogging up. I couldn't really see what I was doing, but these guys knew exactly what they were doing, and they took down the target, like I said, within 5 minutes. And if it was me alone in there, there's no way. So kudos to them.
Oh, that's good. That's a nice reassurance on their physical health and maybe a little bit question of yours.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much, Scott.
Thank you.
We are here with Art Illman, who is one of our Daily News staff photographers and was along with Scott Calzaleo for the Franklin active shooter drill. You were, unlike Scott, you weren't with the group of police officers. You were kind of shooting around them and stuff. How do you set up shots like that in a situation like that? I know that you've been doing these for years.
Situation like that. You're sort of given a free rein to do whatever you want, while at the same time trying not to get shot by those paintballs.
Yeah, that does not sound like it. From what I was told, that would not be comfortable if you had gotten shot by those.
Right. So, like in the beginning, you can just sort of do whatever you want.
Okay.
You know, yep. So I just sort of ran in with them. Two cameras, the first time. The second time, I went back and did it with my iPhone.
So that we could get the video,
correct,
right?
Correct. And then at one point, I was in the hallway, and one of the police officers said, the bad guy is going to come out of there. And the good guys had already run down the hall, so he was going to surprise them from the back. He said, do whatever you want. So I'm thinking to myself, they're going to start shooting at each other. So I sort of went into a classroom doorway and hoped that I wasn't hit by any bullets when they were shooting at each other.
Right.
I don't know, like, you know, if you're shooting a golf match, sometimes a golf ball can come whizzing by you and hit you.
I feel like that would be interference if you got hit by the golf ball.
Yeah. So in that regard, it's... It's very comfortable to shoot because there's no pressure and no there's no pressure from it being reality, sort of.
Right.
You know.
I mean, as you think about lining up those shots, what are you thinking? What are you looking for in a situation like that?
Well, you know, it's fast moving, so a lot of it, I think, just is instinct. You're sort of looking for wide shots and tighter shots, and there's really no time to say, gee, I'm going to find a beautiful frame and wait for something to come into it. So I think it's just having shot so much, you just sort of automatically frame things and just keep shooting.
Yeah.
So a wide-angle lens on one lens and a telephoto on the other.
I know as a reporter and as an editor, sometimes going into these scenes when you're seeing the drills helps you understand what might be going on if something like this happened in real life or with the pressure of really a real tragedy going on. Does, as a photographer, does that help having done this, or does it worked the other way, having been at real situations? Does it change how you look at one of these drills?
Yeah, that's nothing like a real situation at all.
Because you're, if we're at a real situation, we are back behind perimeter and stuff.
Right, yeah. They, you know, at a real crime scene, the police can pretty much restrict where you go.
Right.
So in this case, it's just, you know, at first you say to yourself, gee, it's terrible that they have to do this. And, but photographically, it's almost like, you know, a fun event to sort of just, you know, be right in there shooting with a wide angle lens, you know, and police are running by you.
Cool. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So today we're welcoming back Carolyn for our second time on our podcast. So welcome back.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I am Caitlin Kelleher, the director of multimedia for the Metro West Daily News and the Milford Daily News. And we are chatting about some of the stories that were very popular on our website this week. So one of the stories you've done for us a couple of times now is how the local Brazilian population is reacting to the World Cup games. You were in the streets last night in Framingham and at Tropical Cafe the week before. Mm-hmm. No, I guess not the week before, a couple days before, as Brazil made it through the group rounds. What were those two experiences like as we get ready for their next match on Monday?
Well, it's definitely a cool experience, especially because, you know, soccer is the most popular sport in the world, but in the United States, it's not as popular as everywhere else. So seeing how excited these other cultures get, like for Brazil, this is like their Super Bowl. So everyone, even if they're not, you know, big soccer junkies, are out there wearing their Brazilian like team shirts and waving their flags, and they're just super excited. And it's a nice time for them to be proud of their country, even though they're not in their country. And it was really cool to see, too, because you saw a lot of people who weren't Brazilian who were out at the at Tropical Cafe or out in the streets, like, celebrating, wearing some of the shirts, like, just kind of this big community.
Particularly because America's not playing this year.
Yes. And Peter Chisholm, who helps out with Tropical Cafe, said that a big thing that he sees during the World Cup, especially in our community, is that Brazil will cheer on the U.S. when Brazil's not playing, and it's nice to see a lot of the non-Brazilian community members cheering on Brazil because they understand that Brazil is such a big part of our community.
Right. Although, apparently, one Mexican fan had their was a little bit, putting a little bit of spirit out there last night, too.
So, yesterday, as the Framingham police were breaking up some of the crowds on the sidewalks, just trying to get everyone to clear out after about an hour out there, I turn around and start walking toward my car, and on the other side of the street, I see what I presume a Mexican-American man wearing a Mexico,
or at least he was, or at least he was really passionate,
a really passionate Mexican soccer fan, in what looked like a soccer jersey and I think matching shorts as well. And then he was pushing like a child's like stroller, but it has like one of those covers on it. And he was just decked out in all Mexico with a sombrero. And it was really funny because I was standing next to my brother, and he's like, "You want to know what's funny about that? Is that they play Mexico on Monday in the first round of the round of 16.
And that's a one game winner take all.
So whoever wins moves on and the other one goes home." And seeing that we do have a decent Mexican community in this area too, I just thought that's going to be a fun game to watch and see the crowd's reaction to that.
Yep. So, it will be, and that game's at 10 a.m.
10 a.m. Monday morning. Yep.
Yeah. And we will have a list in this weekend's paper about which local restaurants and cafes and stuff are opening up, that, because you're working on pulling that together for us. Kind of, I don't know, speaking of the Mexican fan, when Mexico won their one of their play-in games, there was actually seismic activity in Mexico that registered, which will lead us to the seismic activity that was felt in Norfolk earlier this week.
Yep.
See my transition there?
Yep.
I'm amused by it. You made a few calls for us on a story this week about the small earthquake in Norfolk. What can you tell us about that story and your interviews with one of our local geologists?
So for us, a 1.3 magnitude earthquake is not common, but it's actually more common than we realize. We just don't hear about it often. So the geologist, Lawrence McKenna from Framingham State, he says that millions of these happen every year. You just might not know about it. And Massachusetts and New England in general used to be a platonic boundary. I don't know the words, but they were a boundary at one point. Now it's in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. So we don't feel these big earthquakes, especially as often as other parts of the country do. But because we were at one point one of these boundaries, we still feel repercussions of it. And so that's why we may experience a 1.3 magnitude earthquake in places like Norfolk. You know, if you're standing in the right spot, you might feel it. But for the most part, if you're just walking around going about your life, you're not going to feel it. If you're asleep, it's not going to wake you up.
And this was one of the ones in the middle of the night. And so people probably didn't wake up. And if they did, it wasn't because of this.
Yeah. And the U.S. Geological Survey had no reports of anyone saying they felt it. So it was just one of those ones where, like, it happened, but if you didn't read it in the news, you probably wouldn't have known.
And a lot of people did read about it on Earth. Yeah. So we were pretty pleased with that. So great. Thank you very much for joining us.
No problem.
Now we welcome Christopher Gavin, who is our Milford reporter, and he is going to kind of catch us up on one of the incidents out of this week's Milford Board of Selectmen's meeting where they unappointed a member of the personnel board, or the chairman of the personnel board. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Caitlin. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So can you give our listeners a brief rundown of what has happened in the last, I'd say, 2 to 3 days?
So Monday night, you know, as the selectmen were making their annual appointments and reappointments to some of the committees that they're and boards they're allowed to do that for, there was a motion made by Selectman Bill Buckley to remove the personnel board chairman Dennis Carroll in the middle of his 5-year term, based upon that he said he received information that he is now living in Mendon and no longer living in Milford. And he just said that, you know, Milford residents should have a Milford resident serving them on their board and looking over personnel board duties. For those who don't know what those are, generally the board sets a lot of the wages and compensation for town employees, except in the school district. And they play active roles in the hiring process as well. So that happened at Monday night's meeting. Now, Dennis Carroll, who was not there, quickly said that that's not true. So I talked to him on Tuesday, and he pointed to some voter registration records at the town clerk's office, which is true, that he is now living at a new address, that he moved out of his old house on West Street, but is now living on in an apartment on West Street, and he's very much a resident in Milford. He did tell me he does have a place in Mendon that he stays at, but, you know, he is a registered voter at a Milford address.
This starts to sound a little bit like a he said situation but that even though his legal address is in Milford, it sounds like the board got a little bit into that kind of fray for a little while.
I should say that Board of Selectmen Chairman Mike Walsh was the opposition vote, out of the 2-1, he was the one, because he had some concern. He said, "Hey, I don't have all the facts. I don't know them personally. I'm not saying that they're wrong, but I haven't reviewed them." Number two, he was a little concerned because they appointed a bunch of new members to the committee that night. He was a little concerned about where the experience was going to lay in that group, since Mr. Carroll was a senior member of the board, and they have actually seen some resignations in the last few months. Now, Carroll also alleges to me that he thinks that he's the victim of political backlash. The personnel board has gone against a few requests made by selectmen in recent months, most recently at last month's town meeting, where the board had sought to in creating this new human resources director position, to have that person be a part of the personnel board. Mr. Carroll got up at the meeting and told everybody that, no, this board should remain independent and should not have a town employee serving on it. And voters ultimately agreed that night. So he's kind of alleging that a lot of this rests on those political disagreements.
So it sounds like this is the former member of the personnel board going to appeal the decision, or is that's I think from your reporting that was still a question he was considering.
Yeah, I had asked him if he was going to be appealing, and he said he wasn't sure that he'd be speaking to his attorney about it.
So it sounds like there may be more to come on this story unless everybody decides to let it lie as it's kind of closed at this point.
Yeah, I think that would be fair to say at this point in time.
So the one of the other big stories that you worked on this week for our Sunday paper was a look at the plans to revitalize the Draper Old Mill in Hopedale. That's, again, another story that's kind of been back and forth for the last few weeks and the last few months as Hopedale tries to figure out what to do with this old mill.
Yeah, well, for those listening and certainly any Hopedale residents listening, this is going to seem like a moment of deja vu for them. When you have a building sitting there for four decades that's a million square feet in the heart of town, and it's been sitting there vacant since it closed in 1980, this isn't the first time there's been chatter around what exactly the town can do with a piece of property that's privately owned. The latest talk comes 10 years after a reuse Draper Corporation Factory Reuse Committee formed a study. But now selectmen have put forth a glimpse at what they're calling the Draper Falls Urban Renewal Plan. It was unveiled last week at a special town meeting. So essentially, this plan is building upon that report from a decade ago. They're saying that they see potential on the site for residential, commercial, and industrial uses. I can break that down a little bit further if you'd like.
Why don't you tell people a little bit about what it is?
So the Urban Renewal Plan, again, this is going off of a 10-minute presentation given to residents by Selectman Tom Wesley last week. He says that, you know, there was this committee that the selectmen formed, and in the last few months they put together this plan. It's calling for the town to enter some sort of public-private partnership with a developer who could bring in approximately 550 residential units to the site, and perhaps 170,000 square feet of commercial buildings. And this would all be alongside some industrial use by the Grafton and Upton Railroad, which folks may recall was also defunct until recently in the last few years where the railroads picked back up. They're envisioning at this point in time there could be a mix of townhouses and condominiums, and there's also talk about maybe perhaps a soccer field and a running track back behind the current ball fields off of Freedom Street. It's detached from the mill property, but nonetheless, it's included in the plan right now. Phil Schwabman, the principal owner of Hopedale Industrial Center, LLC, they own the factory for the last 30 years. I reached out to him last week, but he had no comment on the plan when I reached out to him by phone.
Cool. And one of the other pieces of this is that these pieces of property were removed from that historic district that went before town meeting just days before this kind of, or even the day that this revitalization plan was kind of put forward to voters.
Well, yeah, we saw, in a separate, sideshow, I should say, of this revitalization plan, there was an effort taken on by the town to create a few local historic districts to be included in the Blackstone River Valley National Historical Park. And naturally, the Draper Corporation factory being a key component of the town's history and really its existence. That study committee had included it in its original proposal. Now, Phil Schwartman, through his attorney in May, fought against that and said that it should be removed, that he wanted all his properties removed out of fear that any regulations that could come with a local historic district would limit his ability to redevelop and sell that site. So we saw those properties ultimately removed from the proposal a few weeks before last week's town meeting, as well as two or three other properties that Mr. Schwartman owns.
Great. And I guess the last story you and I will touch on this week is Milford's 4th of July Day parade. It seems like that's ready to go.
Yeah, so this is a real first for the town of Milford, believe it or not, a town that has, Memorial Day parade, Veterans Day parade, has even a Christmas for a Santa parade, as everyone calls it in town, that brings thousands of people each year. So we saw a committee formed by Joe Callery and Ray Osier back in February, the two residents who came forward and said to Selectmen, hey, we want to get something off the ground for the 4th of July, some sort of parade very similar to the Santa parade down Main Street into the heart of downtown Milford. So this week, basically, you know, we're a week out, now a little less than a week, and they're saying, yeah, they're set to go. They're expecting about 40 entries in the parade, and that's all ranging from stilt walkers and hula hoopers to two musical performers who I'm told will be playing, making music on top of moving floats. There'll be two New England Patriots cheerleaders there. There'll be a kids parade with bikes and scooters. Really just everything under the sun that you can think of that would go into a holiday parade.
Just sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun for the 4th.
Yeah. They're saying that this is going to be a start of a new tradition for town. You know, it's going to come on the heels of the annual July 3rd fireworks event. Plains Park in Milford off Cedar Street happens the night before, so everyone can go check out the sights and the sounds of the fireworks and then head over to the parade next morning. A step off is at 10 a.m.
And we have a listing of all the area fireworks up on both the Metro West Daily News website and the Milford Daily News website that has been compiled through a lot of our staff members here. So it's a good resource as people are looking to plan their holiday week. So, well, thank you very much for joining us, Chris.
Thanks for having me back, Caitlin. Appreciate it.
Of course, have a good night or good day.
Thanks, you too.
Bye. So that is all for this week's episode of the Daily News Roundup. And I want to thank the reporters that have joined us today to talk about their stories. And we'll be back next week for our regular edition of the Daily News Roundup. In the meantime, you can check out the links for all the stories and photo galleries that we discussed today in the show notes and on our websites. You can keep up with us daily at MetroWestDailyNews.com and MilfordDailyNews.com. You can subscribe to our apps, our newsletters, and all of those fun things. We will reach you anywhere and everywhere you want us to be with you. We thank you for subscribing to the podcast, which you can find in iTunes or Google Play. And I want to thank everybody for listening. Thanks very much. Have a good day.